Today's program was brought to you by Blueprint, the original juice cleanse program to offer different levels of intensity depending on your needs and current diet. For more information, visit blueprint.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Good morning. You're listening to In the Drink on heritageradionetwork.org. I am the new guy who got stuck with the early slide. I'm Joe Campanelli, the host of In the Drink. And it is early. It's 10 a.m., especially for people in the restaurant industry. And we have one here today. In the bar industry, I should say. Mr. Phil Ward, very happy to have you on the show. Phil, welcome to In the Drink.
Thanks, Joe. Nice to be here. But it is early.
It is early. Thank you so much for getting up so early.
It's good. I'll try to be productive today. Make the most of it.
Phil is without a doubt one of the most inspiring bartenders here in the United States of America. It's exciting bar programs kind of around the country now, and at this point around the world with the new partnership with the Fatty Crew guys heading over to Hong Kong.
Yes, that was my first foray across the pond.
As well as Mayoel here in the East Village or downtown New York City. It's a great tequila mezcal bar. And he was for many years the head bartender at Death & Company. How did you get to work with all these great people and pretty amazing resume you have?
Well, it started out like a lot of things in life, like just dumb luck. I was 28 years old. I lived in Pittsburgh. I was tired of Pittsburgh, so I threw everything I owned away and bought a flight to Rome. And I decided I was just going to try to stay over in like Europe. And I didn't do any planning, so I didn't figure out anything like paperwork and things like that for working. So when I got over there, I realized like, wow, I'm an idiot. I didn't do any research about this. So I was like, all right, I'll just keep traveling and see if something like falls into the seat of my pants. And then like 4 months later, nothing fell into the seat of my pants. And I was running out of money. So I was like, all right, I'm going to go home now before I'm totally broke and stuff like that. I flew back to New York because I'd been here one other time and I had an interesting weekend. I had a friend who lived here and I was in Greece and it was like $500 to fly back to New York, where I was like $1,400 to fly to Pittsburgh. So I figured I'd fly to New York, spend a week here, see my friend who lived here, and then just go back home and probably shoot myself. But through the course of the week, that I was visiting my friend, I met her friend Ricky Chips, who was in a punk rock band. I can't remember the name of the band.
Was that his real name, Ricky Chips?
I don't know.
Yeah, that's maybe his punk rock band.
Yeah, could be. Yeah. Really cool guy, though. But they lived right out here in Bushwick, and he was desperate to sublet his place because he was going on tour with his band to Europe. So he gave me a sublet for a month for like $300. So I was like, oh shit, I have like a 30-day tryout in New York for like $300. So I did that and wound up staying, obviously. But I was a waiter more than a bartender in Pittsburgh. So I got a couple jobs one job really at Fiamma as a waiter, which was one of the worst jobs I ever had. And then after I left there, luckily I got a job as a barback at a Flatiron Lounge. And that was about 6 weeks after they opened. It was just ridiculous timing because at that time, about the only two other places in the city where you could get good drinks was Angel Share and Milk and Honey. Mm-hmm. That was like a combined 70 seats. Like employees only wasn't even open, yet.
So at this time, was the restaurant industry, being a server, was this something that you love doing, or this is something you're doing while you were figuring it out?
No, it was something I did to make money. I in Pittsburgh, all I like to do was like read books and spend a lot of time in my own head and things like that. Like, it was really something I did just to make money. I didn't really get crazy about it until I remember when I got hired at Flatiron. Julie Reiner, my boss and the owner there, she asked me, like, would you ever want to bartend? And I said, no. And she's like, well, I was like, because like to me at that time, bartending was serving like vodka tonics and Miller Lights to douchebags in Pittsburgh and wasn't worth the social interaction. So I had like, I had no desire to actually bartend. And then I remember the first shift I was working at Flatiron bar backing, I'm watching, I'm like, what are these people doing? They're putting like five things in that drink, you know, it's really weird. And then I tasted one, and I'm like, holy, this is unbelievable. Like this is, I've never tasted anything like this, you know? And so I just got really interested in it then. And that's when I really started enjoying the industry more.
So did you go back to Julie and be like, remember what I said about not wanting to bartend?
No, basically, I don't want to toot my own horn, but I think I was about the best bar back in the history of the earth. Like I pretty much, she knew not only was I a good bar back, but she knew that I knew how to make all the drinks. Cause I'd watch everybody make the drinks. We only had like, probably like 10, 12 drinks on the menu at that time. And every once in a while, if we were really screwed in, you know, me and her, we used to work Tuesdays together. This is way back. And, you know, if she was really, really screwed on the point, it would just be us. And she was the one bartender. And Flatiron's a big bar, and we could get pretty busy on Tuesday. So every once in a while, like the easiest drink, like a Hanalei Sun, which was basically just like shaking 3.5 ounces of pineapple-infused rum, she would let me make a drink. But the way I finally got my first bar shift was she knew I knew how to make all the drinks. And one Sunday, a bartender called off. And it's hard to get a bartender to work on Sunday at all, let alone last minute calling one in. So she called me to come in and cover a Sunday. And that's how I got my first bar shift. And then eventually worked my way into bartending.
Do you remember this first shift?
You know what's really odd? I remember that about it, but I really don't remember it much. Uh-huh. And then the other thing, too, was I wound up working Sundays there. And Sundays were a weird day there because you work Saturday nights and it's just a mob scene. Mm-hmm. Lots of like half the, you know, 10, maybe, I don't know how many staff was there. Maybe like 6 to 10 with like managers and security guards. And then Sundays you'd go in and you were just by yourself. Like there was a door guy who would come in at like 10 p.m. I think, but you'd just be there by yourself the whole afternoon. And it was so odd because the rest of the week there was always people there. And I worked that shift for probably like a year and a half. So I think it all blended together. So I don't remember that shift, which is an interesting question. I never really thought of that.
Yeah, I mean, I remember the first time, you know, being on the floor as a server, as a sommelier. Very distinctly, mostly because I was scared out of my mind that I was going to do something terrible and had nightmares about it.
Yeah, I have some memory recollection of like first bartending and being like, it's weird because it was nice, but that was one of the reasons why I like bar backing more than waiting tables, because you got to work in a fun atmosphere and like most of the people in the bar business are, to a degree, they know how to laugh, they're sarcastic, they're fun to be around to a degree. But you don't have to deal with the customers, you know, which is nice because I'm not the most gigantic people person. Like the thing that I like about the type of bartending I got into with cocktails was you had the cocktails as like a common language in between you to like talk about. So you didn't just have to like just blather nonsense nonstop or something like that. I mean, it's still, you meet people who it's great to do that with or something, but that's why I like bar backing, because you could just lay back, do your job, hang out with the people you were there, and not have to get up early. Yeah, thanks again, Joe.
Thank you again. I appreciate you jumping on the G train for me this morning and for all of us. But what part of the job of the bartender do you think that personality and interacting with guests really is? And is it enough to just make the best drink best drink for the guests?
Absolutely not. I think even like you probably have like you have several different parts about like bartending and stuff like that. Obviously, it's very important to be. I mean, it depends on what bar you're working in. I mean, a lot of people still work in bars where, you know, it's the same 30 bars that are on every bar in the world, and you know it's light beer and. You know, some of those people are great bartenders because people come in to see them all the time because they're entertaining, the guests like them, this and that. So I think personality really is a big thing. Also, besides the fact of making a good drink, is like efficiency. Like I think, you know, one of the most important things in the bar business is like making sure your bar's set up well and the bar runs well. You know, because, you know, even if you make good drinks, like we've probably all been in a bar somewhere where supposedly they made good drinks and, you know, you go there and it takes like 10, 15 minutes to get a drink. That's just unacceptable. You know, so I really think besides the personality of the bartender, it's also like the efficiency of the bartender. Like, I mean, I've been in bars where I've watched bartenders working and it's actually painful to like watch how slow they are. It's just like you've got to realize, like, you know, like walking, like one of the things that kills me is when you walk into a bar and maybe you're even there in the bar already and it's not you. Because I'm always really super, 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 super patient. You know, I've never, like, people who wave money at bartenders, you put their hand up or wave at them, they're just, I can't stand them. So I will sit there and, like, die of dehydration before I will ever do that. But when you're sitting at a bar and you can, like, watch people and, like, when people walk into a bar and the bartender does not acknowledge them, there's absolutely no excuse for that. You almost always have time to just give them a menu or something, but there's absolutely no excuse for like never making at least eye contact. All you have to do is swivel your head just the tiniest bit, little nod, doesn't take your energy. You should be able to, if you're a bartender, you're a multitasker, and you should be able to do that while you're doing whatever you're doing.
I agree with that. At our bar, Anfora, we give everyone water as soon as they come in. This way, at least they have something in front of them. They know that we know that they're there.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the
Water's good. Menu's better. Menu before water.
Yeah.
Personally, I think it's always nice giving people water when they sit down. I think like bars without menus, I think they're crazy because it's like you're,
for sure.
It buys you time. It's your ambassador. It's a place to start. Things like that.
And it tells everyone else, like, oh, that person has already been greeted. Like, I know.
Yeah. Yeah,
but if there's nothing in front of them, then...
Yeah. Well, that one gets cloudy because people always want to hang on to the menu if it's an interesting place. And it's like, you're screwing up the system here, people. But you have to let them.
So would you say that... what would you say were the biggest lessons you learned from your time at Flatiron Lounge that you brought on to future jobs?
You know, Jolie, the one thing is like Jolie obviously taught me how to make a drink. She was the first person who taught me how to make a drink and things like that. But the thing she did is like what we were talking about just now, like efficiency and like business. Like she's a good businesswoman. Like, and she'll, you know, she doesn't care if she's not the greatest, geekiest cocktail maker in the world. She makes great drinks and she's a great businesswoman, and you know that's what's more important to her. And I still, you know, things the way she ran her bar and like always tried to keep her staff like smaller, so, and having the managers bust their ass to like make sure the staff makes money, things like that, I think a lot of that I've taken away. Also learned that it's really bad to have a lot of shoes in the office. I remember she used to always complain about everybody having their shoes in the office. I'm like, what's this woman talking about? It's not a big deal. And it's really funny because I still have all these Jolie Reiner moments as a business owner now where I'm like, God damn it, that's what Jolie used to say, you know? And because we used to like squabble about things and stuff like that. And so that's really funny. I remember she used to, we'd be behind the bar and she couldn't remember her recipes. I'd be like, what the hell's wrong with you? It's your recipe. How can you not remember your recipe? She'd be like, you just wait. And like now every time I can't remember one of my recipes, I hear Jolie like laughing at me in the background.
Oh, like I am taking so much solace in this because that happens to me all the time.
Yeah.
In reality, actually, most of the cocktails at the restaurants aren't mine anymore, mm-hmm. Which is a better thing for the quality of the cocktails. Yeah. But even the ones that I have created that are still on the lists, sometimes I have a hard time remembering them, and I feel better about that now. So thank you.
Yeah.
So thank you.
Oh, it's all of us, Joe, I think.
and part of that is probably we're just getting old.
This is true too.
Anyway, on to the next adventure. You left the Flatiron Lounge, and did you immediately hook up with the Death and Company folks?
No, I helped Audrey open the Pegu Club at between then and there.
Okay.
Yeah.
Another one of the great cocktail bars in the city.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking about. Like, just the dumb luck of, like, when I got into this, when I did, it's kind of retarded. Like, when I look back the way it worked, it's really funny.
Yeah. Wow. And then, so then you helped open Milk and Honey and PDT this.
That wasn't my work. But it was fun to be like opening bars when those places were. It was really exciting. Yeah. You know, every time a new bar opened then, it was like a really big deal.
This is not too long ago.
No. I mean, we're talking Flatiron. I mean, Pegu, Flatiron opened it'll be, I think it'll be 11 years, or it was 11 years this year, I think. So I think Pegu should be up to like about 7 or 8 years now, mm-hmm. then, I think, if my math is right. And then I guess DNC and PDT would be probably about 7-ish too, I think, 6 or 7.
Yeah. What do you think has changed in the city that has allowed for these places to open and thrive that just didn't exist 12 years ago?
You know, honestly, like I always say, ignorance isn't bliss. It's a vodka tonic. It's like people didn't know these things existed, and it's really easy to make good customers for cocktail bars because most people, like what I was talking about at Flatiron, the first time I tasted one of those drinks, I'm like, mm-hmm. Jesus, what is this? I didn't know this existed. And a lot of people never knew that. And I think once you have a good drink, you know, you still go back and you'll still have like your little standard whatever, sometimes vodka tonic, things like that. But I think once you really get hooked, you're hooked. And not only are you hooked, but you're like dragging your friends, like, you have to come try this. This is so weird because it's like a total new experience. And I'm, you know, if you look at New York, the way people love to eat and go out and, you know, try new places and things like that, it's really kind of ridiculous that it took that long for people to start going out and searching out, you know, the same, being a foodie in liquid form, mm-hmm. instead of just chewing it.
I agree. Know? I mean, in terms of the food, there people have been pushing the envelope with food, even the wine programs. Interesting beers have been around a little bit longer than that, but it's just recent. And I think the exciting thing is that it's really happening exponentially. It's really exploding.
Yeah, I think really it's it was like word of mouth. And a really great thing too is like, you know, press people can be really annoying sometimes, but I really think they helped a lot by starting to write about drinks more. And I think it's the same thing. It was the same thing with them where they've written about food for so long. They were probably so excited to write about drinks, you know, something new to write about, a new subject that's really cool and different and things like that. So I think that played a big part of it too. And now you have so many places where you can hardly walk into a new restaurant without them having some sort of cocktail list. And, you know, it's not necessarily always good, but it's at least pushing the envelope and saying, you know, hey, we're doing something different here and getting opening people's eyes to the possibilities. Like,
I agree with that. So on that note, we are going to take a short break and we'll be right back with Phil Ward on In the Drink.
Blueprint is the original juice cleanse program to offer different levels of intensity depending on your needs and current diet. Designed to purify and detoxify, Blueprint Cleanse is made from the freshest 100% raw and USDA certified organic ingredients, cold pressed to retain nutrients and flavor. Blueprint also offers a line of organic juices, cold pressed and raw, in a variety of fruit and vegetable combinations and available in individual bottles. Blueprint Cleanse is available at Whole Foods Market and many other retailers across the U.S. To learn more about their line of organic cleanses, juices, and other products, visit them today at blueprint.com or call them at 866-774-6831. That's 866-774-6831. Work hard, play hard. Cleanse, repeat.
You are listening to Ancestors by Peels here on Heritage Radio Network.
We're back on In the Drink at HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Joe Campanelli, here with Phil Ward, and we're talking about cocktail bars here in New York City. And Phil has worked at most of the great ones. You know, and when all of those bars were opening, whether it was Flatiron Lounge, Pegu Club, PDT, your bar Myoel, or Death and Company, actually, which you were a head bartender of for years, and came back, and you were telling me you've done a little stint back there to help out for fun. You know, I was here in the city. I went to NYU and saw them popping up all around, and we were just talking about how that the bar programs have actually, or great bars have influenced restaurant programs, and I think that's really interesting as well.
Yeah, well, I mean, like we were talking about, did we talk about that? Yeah, that was what we were talking about.
Yeah,
is it's really dumb where you have a city where people love to drink, and you know, you'd go to like, I remember one time I took my girlfriend to La Bernardin, I think, that really fancy French place for something like an anniversary or a birthday or something like that. And, you know, before I have a really fancy meal, I want a nice cocktail. I want like, you know, but like a Manhattan or a Negroni or like a martini, something that's just like really going to burn a hole in your stomach and get you hungry because you want to eat a lot and stuff like that. And, you know, you'd go to restaurants like that and they wouldn't even be able to make like a good Manhattan or a good martini or even a freaking Negroni, which is just like equal parts booze. And you could even get it over ice, you know. So it's just that contradiction was ridiculous to me. And it's great now. I think you're seeing like what you were saying, mm-hmm. where people are starting to restaurants. I think it's going both ways because you're having restaurants now who are having better drink programs, and you're also having like cocktail bars now are also starting to have food. That's a really big thing, like Flatiron, no food. I guess in Angel Share, little... no food. Milk and Honey, no food.
Right.
Death and Company, we did have food. I guess Employees Only might have been the first cocktail bar that really put a focus on food too, which was a really good idea. And now you're seeing like almost no cocktail bars open without food, which I think is a great idea.
Well, I think it's smart. You end up staying around for another drink if you have a little bite in front of you.
Yep. I can still remember people coming into Flatiron and they'd have like 2-3 drinks and they'd be like, do you have a food menu? They'd be like, sorry, we don't. And this was 10 years ago when people weren't really used to having 2-2.5 ounces of booze in their drinks. And they'd be like, well, we're sorry. Can we have the check? We got to leave. We got to go get something to eat, you know? So I think it's good that I think it's going both ways, actually.
And when you open your bar, Myoel, food.
Yeah. Oh, no. Food was a very pertinent part of the plan. Because back then, like, there really wasn't many, like, Employees Only was doing food. PDT had hot dogs. I mean, we did, you know, places like Pegu and Death and Company, like, we had small plates and things like that. But the food wasn't really, it was almost more like we tried to be nice and do, like, it'd be really good, but it really wasn't, like, on par with the drinks and stuff like that. And one of the plans for Myoel was to really, I really wanted people to come in there to eat as well. Because, I mean, really, it's A, like what we're talking about, you have to have people come in and have something to eat so they can keep drinking. But also, it's just a good business model, you know, because like early in the week, early in the night, you know, you're not always going to get as many cocktail nerds and people coming out to drink at that time. So, you know, Myoel is great because early in the night, early in the week, we have people coming in for dinner, you know. So I always say we're not a restaurant or a bar, we're a hybrid because, you know, we probably do like between like 30, like if you round it off, probably like 30-35% food sales, which I think is a pretty good model because you make so much more money off of booze, you know, but we still have enough people who come in there to eat, you know, so we have people who come there to eat, mm-hmm. we have people who come there to drink and everything in between.
And tell us, do you have any larger guiding principles when it comes to choosing something to eat with a drink?
What do you mean?
Like, what are some, like, pairing
you're
ideas?
You're talking about me?
Yeah.
Like, when I go out to eat?
Yeah. Is it just when you're in the mood to eat or whatever you're in the mood to drink and that works?
Honestly, I'm a weird... I mean, I do believe in pairings. I've tasted things that I enjoy pairing. But personally, like, you know, when me and my girlfriend we cook a lot and stuff like that. We'll go out, we'll buy, like, 2 bottles of wine, and we'll usually drink all the wine while we're cooking and then eat dinner without wine. Like, I don't even like to drink like water when I eat usually. Like, a lot of times, like if I'm drinking wine or stuff with dinner, even if we have wine left over, I'll drink the wine until we start eating and then I'll eat and then I'll start drinking wine again. So myself personally, I'm not a huge like pair. Like, my favorite pairing would probably definitely be in Mexico. I love drinking tequila and mezcal with tacos or beer and things like that. But as far as like wine and things like that go, I'm not a really huge fan.
So you'd say you like those pairings that kind of culturally make sense together.
Something like that.
The ethnic food with the ethnic drinks.
Because actually the other one I was going to bring up, like regular, like, you know, regular wine, I'm not usually real keen on that, eating it with food. Even though, you know, I love red wine, I love pasta. It's probably one of my favorite foods, but I don't really enjoy drinking it with the food. But then the other one is probably sherry. Like, I love drinking sherry with like, you know, anything, jamon, tapas, like, because those, they just go together. And sherry, it's like so dry and crisp. It's like the flavor complements the food, but then it just like, it cleanses your palate too, and you're ready for another bite. Like, mm-hmm. I feel like, you know, normal wine, it just kind of muddies your palate, so to speak. I'd rather just drink it by itself and then eat and then drink the rest of the wine.
Well, I mean, hearing you describe sherries make me hungry, but I'm going to disagree with you on the other part. Yeah.
Oh, no. I'm just saying from my personal taste, you know.
So let's go back to the your thoughts about Mexican drinks like tequila and mezcal. How did you get into that? I know your bar Mayuel is based on agave-based drinks.
Yeah. Honestly, you know, going back to Flatiron days, the way I always credit myself, besides Jolie teaching me how to bartend and make a drink, was by reading old books. I think any bartender who wants to be a good bartender, they have to read the classics. Like today, I think you have way too many bartenders who get a job in a bar. They get taught how to make 12 of the house cocktails, and all of a sudden they're a mixologist and they're a genius. Whereas I think the way mm-hmm. to actually become a good bartender is you got to read all the old books, because basically you read all the old books, you learn the classics, and you learn balance and structure. And that's the most important part of drink making. It's like balance and structure. Like every good template is a blueprint for making more good drinks. Like I really don't understand why people have a hard time making drinks. And I think it's because they don't read all the old books and they don't learn balance and structure. So that's basically how I credit myself with learning how to make drinks after Jolie taught me mm-hmm. how to make drinks.
What's your required reading list?
I don't know if I want to go through a required
reading list. You don't have to. That's
but,
okay.
You know, it goes from everything. It goes from, like, older books like the Savoy to, like, things like... I love Gary Regan's books. And, you know, the books I was reading then, there weren't nearly as many good books there are now.
Yeah.
Dave Wondrich is a must. He's probably... Dave Wondrich, and, you know, his books are great historically, too. Another one of favorite of mine was The Gentleman's Companion by Charles mm-hmm. H. Baker.
I find I keep rereading Imbibe. That's like the one that I keep.
I mean, Dave's books read like a novel. I mean, they're great. Him and Gary, I think they're the two best writers. Like The Joy of Mixology, which I have to say, Gary was a terrible name for a drink, or a drink book. But it's like the beginning. Usually, you're like getting through like the beginning part where you're reading shit, and you're like, all right, can we get to the recipes? But that book, it's like you get to the recipes, you're like, damn, it's over. Like, he's just such a funny bird. But back to the tequila mezcal thing, like I said, that's where I feel like I really learned how to make drinks, was the old books. And, you know, as a bartender, you want to try something new. And when you read the old books, there's really no tequila recipes, and there's damn well no damn mezcal drinks in there. And, so, you know, I'd always enjoyed tequila, you know, and so I started gravitating towards tequila, trying tequila in drinks, you know, mm-hmm. and, that's what I had a little luck with. Like the first drink I think I ever got on a menu, was at the Flatiron. It was the La Pera, which was like just like a tequila sour with a Bartlett pear, things like that. And so I just started like Pegu Club. I think a couple of the drinks I got on the menu there were also tequila. And so I just started gravitating to it more and more. And then once Death & Company opened and I was more in charge of the drinks and things like that, you know, I went right for it. And then I discovered spicy drinks. And that really was a big game changer. And then just started making more and more tequila drinks. And then I tasted mezcal for the first time and put mezcal in a drink. And I'm just like, that is ridiculous. did that just happen? Like, I remember the first mezcal cocktail I ever made was for Lynette Moraro at table two. She asked me for something, and I made her a barbancourt daiquiri with a quarter ounce of mezcal in it. And I was just like, that can't be possible that a quarter ounce of mezcal made a daiquiri taste like that. And that was just like, ding, like the light went on. Mm-hmm. And from that point on, it's just started making a lot more drinks with tequila and mezcal. And then, you know, at that point, that, you know, 2 years into Death & Co., or maybe a year and a half, we had our menu up to like probably, I think we had like 70 drinks or something at one point, and we had it broken up by section. So we had like the tequila agave page at that point, the gin page, the whiskey page, all that shit. And a lot of the nights, you know, we would sell more tequila and mezcal cocktails than anything else. So when it was time that somebody was like, do you want to open your own bar? I was like, yes. And they're like, well, what should we do? It was like 10 seconds. I was like, we have to do the tequila mezcal cocktail bar. And then after that, I started traveling to Mexico mm-hmm. and going down and meeting, like, going to Oaxaca, meeting the Zapotecs, visiting the Palenques. And then it's just, it was over then. Like, I just fell. Every time I go to Mexico, I fall more and more in love with it. And it's, and same thing with mezcal.
Yeah, and it seems like it was really good timing as well, that the face of what tequila and mezcal based drinks are here in New York, at least what we've been seeing in the early 2000s versus the late, like there are a lot better products that are available
yeah.
as well.
There is that. I think like when we opened Mayuel, we had 12 mezcals. We now have over 40. And you know,
that's so, in 4 years, right?
Yeah. So that is definitely, I really think, you know, this whole mezcal thing, like when we actually won, best new cocktail bar at Tales of the Cocktail.
Yes, you did. Congratulations.
And when I did that, it was so weird because I was sitting with Ron Cooper from Del Maguey, and it was Ron Cooper's birthday. And I gave Ron Cooper my award because all I did was he made my job easy by getting us the good shit.
Yeah.
Like it's like we were just lucky, but all we were doing was like following in Ron Cooper's footsteps because like Del Maguey like totally trailblazed the whole mezcal category mm-hmm. in this country yep. and made bars like Mayuel possible. But on that note, you know, you saw also not just like for bars like us to be possible, but for other people to realize, wow, people actually do like this stuff. And like people are bringing in more and more mezcals now. And it's just, it's great. It's absolutely great.
Yeah. I have to ask you, do you feel that agave based drinks give you a different kind of drunk?
Well, I will tell you this. I know, mezcal, I always say mezcal doesn't make me feel drunk. It makes me feel happy. Like I remember on my 36th birthday, a couple years ago, we went down to Oaxaca for Day of the Dead. I got on a red eye here at maybe 12 a.m., flew down, got in about 6, met Ron Cooper and like Misty Kalkoffin, a couple other people at the hotel where we always stayed, or the little ranch or whatever the hell you want to call it. And at about 8 o'clock, I had my first Copita for the day. And I said, I'm going to drink 36 Copitas, one for every year. And so we marked them on my arm with a Sharpie in like fives, you know, so we didn't lose count because everybody else was drinking all day too. No sleep after a red eye, 36 Copitas, woke up the next day feeling fine. Like, it really is. It really is a different spirit. And it's weird because
Was this all Del Maguey?
Actually, it was weird because it was all Del Maguey because we were visiting the Palenques that day.
Mm-hmm.
So we were going to the Palenques where they make it. And we saw, I don't remember, I think we went to Chichicapa and Minera that day. So I think we went to 2 Del Maguey Palenques. And then it was odd because we wound up in, I remember I was up to about 32 or 33, and we drove back to Oaxaca City. And then I remember,
hopefully you weren't the one driving.
No, I was not. I actually, it was funny because I remember I like ate tacos in my sleep because I kind of like passed out in the van, and then we were supposed to go eat tacos. So like Misty like had to wake me up, and then I kind of like slept, walked to the table and sat down, and then ate some tacos. And then we went to Los Amantes has a tasting room there, and I think the last 3 I actually drank was Los Amantes.
Wow.
Wow. You know, but mezcal, I'll drink it, and sometimes it gets frustrating. You're like, you actually want to get drunk, and like I have to drink beer with it so I can get a proper buzz, because it just makes me feel like happy and things like that. Unless you drink it to get drunk. Yeah. And like sometimes I'll be in a mood or I'll be ready to go, and I'll drink mezcal to get drunk, and boy does it punish you. It knows when you're drinking it, when you're abusing it.
Yeah, you need to treat mezcal with love, and then it makes you happy.
You do.
Yeah. I have to ask you also. I've got from Steve Olson and the Del Maguey guys
the little copitas.
Yeah. Is that how you? They're little kind of clay. Yeah. They look like very very shallow pots.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the only way I like to drink mezcal. Like when you drink it, like what he did for those, like when you go to Oaxaca, they drink them out of jicaras, which are it's kind of like a round squash, you know, it's totally perfectly round. They cut them in half, and then they gore them out. So it's basically a little bowl made out of a squash shell or whatever, and that's what they drink the mezcal out of there. So that's the copitos are made to emulate that, but. If I drink, you know, if I go to a bar to drink, you know, mezcal, and they'll give it to me like in a small rocks glass, I can't stand it. Because, like, remember how they used to say you should drink spirits out of a brandy snifter because you get all the flavors in that, but it's actually a bad idea because you get that gas cloud in there where you actually can't really, breathe the smell the spirit too much because you burn your nose and stuff like that. That's what I get all the time now, like, if I don't drink it out of a copita. And it's just habit, too, but... I actually always keep them in my bag. So if I go to a bar and
get
mezcal, I'll just take the rocks glass and fill up my copita and drink out of that.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
That's amazing. And there's an old Mexican expression about how beans always taste better in a clay pot than a metal one as well.
Oh, is there?
Yeah.
Okay. That makes sense, though.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, we're out of time, but I can't thank you. I can't thank you enough. You know, we didn't even get to talk about, because you have so many interesting things going on about your project in L.A. And your work with the Fatty Crab guys. We love the Fatty Crew. I think that I've been to Fatty Crab more than any other restaurant in my life. It's just always a great time there. And you're doing some work in Hong Kong with them.
Yeah.
That's pretty excited. Yeah, maybe we have one more minute. Talk about. Well, just tell us about what you're doing, the Fatty Crab guys, and what it's like to work in Hong Kong, and then we'll wrap it up.
It's good. They're a great company. I've always loved their food. I've known Colin for a long time. So just basically redoing the cocktail list at all the restaurants. And then we have one list for the queue, one list for the crab. And then also May they open the Fatty Crab in Hong Kong, but it's like sort of across. They're doing a little barbecue stuff there too, and that was a really great experience. You know, like that's the great thing about this job is you get to work and travel sometimes, and it was interesting experience. You know, like they don't deliver booze if it's raining, which is kind of weird. It's a little bit of a slower pace there. it was challenging. Nobody wants to be a server, which is weird. Everybody wants to be a hostess instead of a server, which is weird.
Which is weird because it's hard to find hostesses.
Yeah, it's like a city full of like 17-year-old white models for some reason, and so everybody wants to be fabulous and be the server, be the hostess, and it's like looked down upon to be a server.
Interesting.
So it was like impossible to find servers there. We had some real special characters.
Well, much easier than heading over to Hong Kong. Head over to Mayowell. Just an always an awesome time. So Phil, thank you so much for being on In
Thanks
the Drink.
Thanks for having me.
This has been awesome. Thanks to all of you for listening. This has been In the Drink on heritageradionetwork.org.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.